Hey there, this is Dr. Christine Stock. The following episode was published earlier this year. Since then, there's an exciting development. Neil Grayson's and Chris Komolaski's vision described in this episode is coming to life. They, along with Dr. Manesh Patel of Duke University, co-founded CypherBridge Research, an integrated research organization with a mission to empower more physicians and patients to take part in clinical research in the communities that can benefit the most. This episode dives into the challenges across the clinical trial ecosystem that led Health 2047 to invest in this team that will democratize clinical trials. Enjoy. Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Christine Stock, and you're listening to So You Want to Transform Healthcare. For today's episode, Democratizing Clinical Trials, I am delighted to welcome my colleagues, Neil Grayson and Chris Komolaski. Neil is a managing director of corporate portfolio and project management at Health 2047. And Chris is an executive director at PPD, a leading global contract research organization, and an advisor to Health 2047. Neil, Chris, and I will discuss how they see the evolving landscape of clinical research, the challenges and trends that are creating new opportunities, and how new approaches can help democratize clinical trials. But first, let me tell you a little bit about Neil and Chris. Neil Grayson is an experienced biotech executive who led multiple merger and acquisition efforts while directing corporate portfolios. She brings over 25 years of experience in strategic planning, drug discovery and development, and management. Prior to joining Health 2047, Neil served as Chief Operating Officer and Vice President of Drug Development at Seattle-based Kindex Pharmaceuticals. Neil earned her PhD in medicinal chemistry from Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine and a Bachelor of Science in Chemistry from Randolph-Macon College. Chris Komolaski has been an informal advisor to the Health 2047 team over this past year. At PPD, he leads several teams in the area of site and patient access, including those responsible for identifying sites for clinical trials. He has extensive experience as a management consultant and healthcare executive with companies such as GlaxoSmithKline and Accenture. Chris earned his MBA from Duke University and his bachelor's degree in systems engineering from the University of Virginia. Now, Neil and Chris, let's hear how you are transforming healthcare. Welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
Thanks for having us. We're excited to be part of the forum.
Great. Well, Neil, when I first heard that you wanted to democratize clinical trials, I had to get out my Funkin' Wagnalls because I thought democratize meant to introduce democratic systems. But you clearly are thinking of the other definition. Can you explain what you mean by your provocative title, Democratizing Clinical Trials?
Sure. Well, first, Chris, to be clear, there isn't any political connotation to the term. What we really mean is opening access and removing barriers to different parts of the clinical trial ecosystem. Specifically, we're talking about opening access to physicians and patients who currently don't or can't participate in trials for various reasons. We need to remove friction in the system and make sure that access is more equitable. And that would involve enabling trials at point of care instead of just at the large academic institutions where most of it occurs today. From a patient lens, it's important to recognize that only a small subset of patients participate today in research, and there's a need to ensure equitable representation in trials, at least equal to general population demographics, and it would be even better if we could get a match to the disease prevalence and where that patient burden is the greatest.
So what you're saying suggests that there is a problem with getting certain patients into clinical trials. Can you talk about the historical landscape that created that lack of access?
Absolutely. So if we think about the clinical research and clinical trial landscape, it has evolved over time. And a lot of that change has mirrored a lot of what you see in that broader pharmaceutical and biotech landscape over the last 30 30 years. And you know, the concentration of clinical research is really always centered on academic medical centers. And there's a few reasons I think that have driven that. You know, first, these centers have the physicians and key opinion leaders that really pharma has been looking for to serve as the primary investigator to lead the clinical programs. Second, they historically have had the patients you'd be looking at to fill the target needs for those studies. And finally, these institutions have heavily invested in the equipment, the infrastructure needed to effectively deliver the studies. So there's a lot of reason why that was the center of the clinical trial universe for a long time. I think what you see over time, you've seen increased R&D investment in the industry. You've seen the improvements in data, analytical approaches and technology, regulatory changes. All of that really has come together to push us into a time and a space in the landscape where we've seen increased flow of pipeline opportunities, increased complexity of the landscape that has really driven changes in terms of what and where some of that can be supported. If you look broadly at industry research from things like the Tufts Center for Drug Development, you'll see a pipeline within the industry that has grown dramatically, and has grown across indications, across therapeutic areas. And I think one of the more recent evolutions in this landscape is that push towards rare diseases, subsets of patient populations that have evolved with precision medicine and more targeted treatments. And I think what you've seen through that evolution is the pace of research has outpaced the capacity at some of these centers. So the studies are becoming more complex. They're becoming more constrained in terms of the inclusion and exclusion criteria that govern if a patient can actually take part in research. And as that capacity has been strained, the centers don't have enough patients to enroll all of the studies. Not to mention, these centers also have a number of competing studies that are looking for the same type of patients at the same time. So all of that, I think, comes together to really challenge the ability for these types of centers to deliver the full portfolio of research. Now, if you think about it a little bit from the pharmaceutical lens, who's reaching out, there's a bias in the industry, both from a pharmaceutical perspective, from the clinical research organization perspective, who outsource and help deliver some of these types of programs where they want to de-risk programs, and they do so by going to the places where they have experience, where they've seen historical delivery. And that hits this a little bit cycle of, coming back to that same pool of institutions and investigators. And that's part of what we think we need to break. When you look at the aggregate statistics of this, what you see today is less than 3% of physicians, 3% of patients that might be eligible actually taking part in clinical research.
So outside of the academic medical centers, I'd also add that it's a really fragmented space. You have large health systems, small and medium-sized community hospitals, and smaller independent and community-based practices. And while there's some established networks of sites out there, these sites have typically still been regionally or therapeutically aligned in their networks. So the smaller and community practices have had challenges being considered for in being able to sustain themselves as clinical research sites. First of all, there's a large upfront cost. We should just acknowledge that to get trained, to build the in-house infrastructure, accumulate the support staff, the data and processes and oversight that's needed to deliver at the level that industry demands. These are all areas that we can explore when we think about the barriers that have been in place for a while for these types of sites to participate.
So you hinted at some of the reasons that including community practices in clinical trials might be a good idea. Can you explain more fully why it is important to include community practices in clinical trials?
Sure. So again, if you go back to the industry, and kind of how it's grown. It's over a $25 billion industry growing over 6% a year. So it's something that at that scale, at that pace, you can't sustain it with some of the historical approaches that are out there. And you know, we touched on that saturation of what we see in the academic centers. You know, just having too many studies, having competing studies, and ultimately, you know, having a lot of the targeted patient populations that are duplicated across some of their opportunities. And I think one thing else to call out is at these centers, you know, there is a skewed patient population of historically it's been older white men that have taken part in research, and in that demographic doesn't represent the broader set of patients in the real world. So I think that's another challenge when we think about going into the community that we're trying to address. You know, really trying to focus on ensuring that there's a representative population for what a drug, you know, may be intended to be used for.
So there are also other aspects that need to be considered. For instance, I've heard that 70% of patients live at least 2 hours from the nearest research center. And that's just too far. And it's not reasonable to expect patients to take part in trials when they live that far away. In some cases, you know, research can last for years, and to expect them to go back and forth in time over time is just not sustainable. So in general, we think that pharma and the public should want research that better represents the population. There's good evidence showing that we should care about conducting research in a broad population. Isn't that right, Chris?
I think that's another really good point, Neil. When you think about, you know, supporting that push to get into a broader set of patients that take part in research. The FDA conducted some research a number of years ago, but through a five-year window from 2008 to 2013, they looked at all of the new molecular entities that were approved, and 21% of that total reported differences across racial or ethnic subgroups. And those differences spanned, you know, some of the pharmacokinetics, the safety, efficacy, and some of the other details. And this is just where those things were explicitly reported in the research. And that wasn't across everything that had been submitted. So it leads you to think that there's more concern and a more potential issue out there than you might otherwise have thought. And I think one specific example, just to kind of make it tangible, is, you know, there's a lupus treatment out there, belimumab, where the efficacy was shown to be less effective in the Black population. And I think, you know, again, when you think about concerning factors, you know, safety and efficacy kind of form the two pillars of what you think about from clinical research. And if one of those, you know, is not working across all the patient populations, you want to know that and you want to be accounting for that. So having that broader patient access can really help you understand better if any of those concerns exist.
Well, so far we've been talking about clinical trials in a very broad sense, but it seems like in any discussion about innovation and change in healthcare, we need to think about how COVID has altered what we're doing. How has COVID affected clinical research? And are these effects just due to the economy's decline, do you think?
I couldn't agree with you more in terms of, you know, this being the topical, you know, issue and discussion point today. And, you know, there's no questioning that it's had a impact on the clinical trial space. And I think it's a lasting impact that's going to shape the industry moving forward. So what we saw, I think, back in March as the pandemic was coming forward, really the clinical trial landscape was one of, you know, I think the most impacted and really one of the early impacted spaces. You saw really through quarter two, many studies either completely stop enrollment, new studies were holding and not starting up. And if you saw any of the research that was published through the different CROs quarterly reports, there was, you know, quotes of 50 to up to 85% of study sites that were impacted significantly through the pandemic and not being able to have their patients come in. Now that slowdown, you know, scaled down and was pulled back a little bit through the rest of the summer and into the fall. But what it did was create a little bit of an opening for new innovation, specifically, I think, in the digitally enabled and virtually decentralized trial space. And this is a set of technologies that has been around for a number of years. And there's just been a little bit of reticence across industry sponsors because they weren't sure how regulators would potentially look at some of these innovative tools within their programs. In a space where pharma is very risk averse, introducing anything new to pivotal programs is something that takes a lot of scrutiny when you think about it. So and when we talk about digital technologies, this is everything from electronic consent forms in terms of how you sign patients up for programs, clinical outcome assessments and patient reported outcomes, telehealth visits, other services that really help enable how you can connect with the patient. And that could be enabling home health service or direct patient shipping of different treatments. So kind of it spans that continuum of different technologies and different ways to enable and connect with patients. But that, I think, has been what we've seen as probably the single biggest shift in the landscape. There's been more openness, and really that's helped lead some of that continuity in the research that's taking place today. There's a lot of industry players now that are have this mantra of new normal, talking about how this is changing the space and this theme of hashtag no going back. And I think really what that means is there's a level of comfort that this change is going to be embedded moving forward. And while I completely agree that there needs to be increased embedding of this type of innovation, and I think it can really revolutionize how this care can be better enabled, I think one of the key tenets that I really strongly believe in is that there's not going to be a lack of need of that traditional brick and mortar clinical research site with a trusted physician as a core part of that process. And I've seen firsthand where some of our studies have attempted to use some of these decentralized approaches and have hit roadblocks because they don't have that direct connectivity and they're looking for ways to actually enable that. So it's something that I think is changing, and I think it will be needed, but I think that, there's components of some of that a traditional approach where the two will eventually merge together.
And Chris, the other area where COVID has shifted the landscape is that it's highlighted some of the existing health inequities, which are also reflected in who participates and benefits from traditional clinical research. So we've seen that the Black and Latinx communities have been hit very hard, and some would say the hardest by COVID. And we should be asking how these communities are represented in the vaccine and treatment trials that are currently ongoing to ensure that there's confidence that these treatments will be safe and effective and that they will work for everyone.
O'Neill, I could not agree more about that. But I'd like to go back to something Chris had talked about, and that is that even though we have these new enabling technology, it doesn't look like that's going to be enough to really make access to clinical trials in community practices. What do you think about that?
One of the things that maybe when you think about that type of question, and yes, technology is an enabler, some of these new things will change how we interact, but there's a number of key players in this ecosystem. And I think there isn't a silver bullet that's going to solve all of those things at once. So I agree with that sentiment. It's whether it's the academic centers, whether it's the community, smaller community practices, those new innovations alone are definitely not going to be the only thing that enables more patients, more physicians to take part. There's a component of, I think, systematic change across the entire landscape that needs to be addressed to further take us forward. So I do think it can open a lot of doors, but there's a lot of additional things that need to be addressed, and how we can bring some of that additional innovation to these smaller sites and practices, I think, is something that will help us, you know, take some of those steps forward.
So basically what you're saying, Chris, is that if physicians are not a key part of the solution, we're not going to be able to realize the full impact of these new technologies. And so maybe to summarize, the new technology platforms can help increase access and make certain types of research more doable, but the technology alone is not sufficient.
I think that's a great summary of that.
So it sounds like you're saying that the technology solutions are maybe necessary, but not sufficient. And if that's true, I'd like to turn now to what is it that has to happen to enable these three necessary parties to participate? And that would be the physicians, their patients, and pharma. And I imagine there's probably obstacles facing all of these groups. Can you talk first about the barriers faced by physicians?
Well, there are a number of barriers that are experienced by physician practices. And first, I might want to point out that there's some timing and administrative barriers. There's no question that the current incentive system in place for doctors rewards high volume patient care, and that leaves very little time to do anything else. And we hear this timing challenge is one of the biggest hurdles that needs to be overcome to enable physicians to participate in clinical research. Also, clinical trials require planning, training, oversight, data capture, and entry. And these are all things that can drive additional focus and overhead for the sites and the physicians who practice there.
Yeah, and then I think maybe in addition to that, when you think about, you know, we mentioned upfront that some of the academic medical centers have invested in infrastructure, but you know, outside of just that new innovation and digital enablement of technology, there's a core set of data, tools, processes that you need to understand and be a bit fluent in to deliver in today's trial landscape effectively, efficiently, and an outcome of quality data for what you're able to deliver to the pharma organization. So I don't think that the doctors have the capacity to stay on that leading edge. If they understand what some of the technology components are, it's really challenging to either invest in all of the right solutions or stay on the leading edge. So I think that's a challenge that needs to be addressed, to say, how can you think about having a partner bring together some of those components to effectively bring a solution to them that they don't need to understand all of the different pieces. And when you think about all of the different stages of a clinical trial, from that early startup through the full study delivery, there's a number of activities that just need timely turnaround. It's upfront feasibility to understand if you're the right fit for a program, if you have the patients, if you have the capacity, in that patient matching, as you're looking to make sure that you're effectively recruiting patients as early as possible in that recruitment window, when you're scheduling patient visits and really delivering care, all of those things, you need you need hands-on support, whether that's people, whether that's process, that challenge needs some level of I think outside support to effectively deliver. And then if you step back a little bit and look at the broader access to information and data, there's things that happen up front, as you're negotiating contracts and budgets, where, if you don't have a lot of experience doing that, you're at a disadvantage. And I think, again, the more of that information that can be aggregated, best practices learned and shared, the better you are to enable the physicians to effectively deliver programs.
You're right, Chris. And another thing that occurs to me as I listen to you talk about this area is that physicians who might be less experienced in the area of clinical research do voice concerns about regulatory commitments and potential liability. They're worried about the potential legal, financial, ethical, and reputational risks that could come with research impacting them either as individuals or for their practice.
I think with that, there's a little bit of lack of visibility, clear communication pathways that impact this as well. So they don't all, physicians don't always have the visibility to understand what research is available, And while certain therapeutic areas may be on the forefront of that, so I think oncology as an example, you know, clinical care, clinical trials as a treatment option is something that I think is a little more commonly thought of there. It's something that, you know, I think just many physicians just can't stay up to the latest as to, you know, what's available and what programs are even coming through the pipeline. And I think that kind of helps you know, create just a little bit of a knowledge sharing challenge that needs to be addressed. And then, you know, I think going back a little bit, you know, maybe the last thing to just highlight again is this challenge that we touched on from a financial lens. And I think, you know, there's concern from a physician practice lens to say, do I have the ability to deliver research, or do I need to potentially refer this patient and, you know, lose that connectivity to them moving forward? And I think there's a lot of reticence across physicians that may feel that taking part in research, their only option to do it is referring them out to other centers to do it. But, you know, that financial concern and the potential, you know, perception that they don't have the staff, that they don't have the administrative team that can help support them, and the workflow that's needed is something that needs to be addressed. And I think, you know, finally, in that financial lens, there's a concern of whether or not this research is sustainable for their practice. Is it going to be helpful to their bottom line and drive positive cash flow or not? And I think there's, you know, there's a lot of evidence to say that, you know, researchers and physicians who have done it in the past, there's a lot of physicians that never do it again because, you know, they might not have been successful from a financial lens. And I think that perception is something that creates a burden that needs to be overcome, because this is something that has the ability to, you know, change that dynamic a good bit for the practices.
Yeah, and I really think overcoming the physician barriers are huge, because the physician's endorsement is so important for the patients. My own experience with it, my very first experience with clinical research was in a rural community hospital. And I spent a lot of time and energy discussing and explaining and enrolling patients in my clinical studies, but very, very few of them declined participation. Now, that was 1981, and those were inpatients, but I always assumed that the high rate of participation was due to the fact that the patient's surgeons recommended to their patients that they enroll in my study. But it sounds like you're suggesting that even if physicians do endorse the study, that there are still some barriers. What do you think are the current patient barriers and concerns about participating in clinical trials?
Before answering that, I do want to touch on, I think you're, what you saw in terms of that trusted physician relationship is very important to continue to kind of reemphasize that. You know, I think I truly believe that is a key component in terms of overcoming some of the barriers and helping to engage. But when you think about patient barriers, I do think, you know, there are many that do exist that need to be addressed. And many of these, I think, are generalizable. One of the things I'll focus on is, you know, thinking about, you know, some of the more prevalent things that we see in underrepresented patient populations and minority populations. I think, you know, there's some unique challenges there that can be addressed. And if you can address those, I think you can, you know, come up with solutions that you know, serve the broader patient populations as well. And I think the first one that I think of in that subset of patients is this lack of understanding of, you know, how clinical trials work overall, and just, you know, an inability to, you know, understand whether or not it's the right care option for them. And, you know, with that, I think there comes a mistrust of the pharmaceutical industry in general, and specifically the clinical trial space. And, you know, there is a very clear history and evidence that supports some of that mistrust. So I don't want to, you know, skip over or kind of, you know, underscore what that has meant to drive that mistrust, but it's something that needs direct attention to overcome. And then I think another component is a bit of implicit bias. And this is where, you know, a physician, you know, may be thinking about what patients do they want to take part in clinical research. And they may kind of just implicitly, you know, think about who is or is not a good candidate. And that split second decision can impact whether a patient is considered a potential candidate ultimately that is offered to consider coming into a clinical research study. And then maybe one last component here. I think there's always a challenge with some of the language and communication barriers as well. And this can manifest in a couple different ways. One is just overall effective communication with the physician, and that physician may not feel comfortable to address some of the very specific patient questions and concerns, whether that's from consent or other aspects, to feel then comfortable to really support and consider them for studies. So I do think it's important to be thinking about this communication challenge and how we can make sure that what we're bringing to them is both culturally and from a language lens appropriate to make sure that a patient can understand what this entails and that they're able to feel comfortable stepping into that type of program.
I'd like to go back to that patient trust in their physicians. If the treating physician is not recommending research as a care option, patients won't even consider it. And if you kind of turn this on its head and say, well, if a majority of physicians are not participating in research today, then you have to conclude that their patients in turn will not have a chance to take part. So I think that lens of the patient-physician relationship is very important, and the physician is a key part of the path forward. There's also logistical barriers that we can't overlook. So many people, again, live so far away from research sites where traditional clinical research occurs, and that makes the burden too high for them to take part. The time commitment to go back and forth can also dissuade people from participating when they have job limitations, when they have the challenge of childcare and other commitments that could prevent them from actually engaging.
So as we talk about this, it really makes me reflect on how important the patient-physician relationship is, not just for clinical trials, but probably in the delivery of quality medicine. And I hope that as medicine and clinical trials move forward, that we can find ways to strengthen that. So we've talked about patients and the doctors, but what about pharma?
Yeah, and I think pharma is another clear stakeholder that has concerns, challenges that needs some attention and focus if you're going to solve some of the challenges that exist today. And I think, overarching, I think the pharma customers, biotech customers, they have a lot of competing pressures. And I think the ultimate goal that they have is, how are they going to de-risk their portfolio of studies and really try to bring them to market as fast as possible at the lowest cost possible. So minimizing that cost lens as well. So this puts extreme, I think, pressure on both pharma and their partners like CROs to, help prioritize historical performance from sites as kind of their anchor point. They go back to what they've seen work and they think you can replicate those things again and again. And that leads you back to that question that we talked about earlier around how can you break that cycle of the saturated academic centers. And I think what this means as well is that there are sites without experience that have a higher hurdle rate to even get considered for studies. And I think if you think about it as well, you have your academic centers that are well-known and established. Beyond that, all of your other smaller practices, community practices, independent practices, it is a much more fragmented space. And when pharma looks broadly, there's a challenge. And it's, how do you effectively connect with them and find the right reliable partners that are willing to kind of invest in the processes at each step along the way to do it efficiently, effectively, and with quality. And really, there's a need to have more, better site networks that can actually bring some of that together to have single points of contact to make some of that connectivity.
So, Chris, earlier you had said that new technologies are helping to overcome some barriers, and facilitating new opportunities for community participation in clinical research. But what else can help to create new opportunities for these practices?
Technology is part of the evolution, part of the solution, and something that needs to be have some consistent theme and focus and investment moving forward. But I do think when you think about the opportunities that are out there, addressing some of those challenges the physicians have that we called out earlier is important. And I think what you see as well is there's a desire from a lot of these physicians to take part in research. And I think that there's a gap in really meeting that and helping them to navigate how to do that and making sure that that voice is heard and that physicians who want to have a full suite of care options for their patients and clinical trials as a care option that might be the best treatment option for a subset of their patients and making sure that that's possible. So it's finding that connectivity to where that need is, where the desire is, and making sure that that there is that broader lens of where that's possible. And then I think there's a component back to raising education and awareness around the financial aspect. And we talked about that challenge of not effectively or having a perception that it could be a risky endeavor for their practice, but really helping to educate them to know that it can be a source of revenue, and in some cases it can augment that revenue beyond what their normal clinical care practice could offer.
Yes, you're right. We've actually spoken to some practices that were barely breaking even until they brought in research as a diversified and complementary revenue stream. So it can actually be quite successful from a financial perspective.
So I think we do need to be able to take that type of case study and story and bring it to them to kind of close that loop and gap and make sure they understand that it can be a important part of their overall business.
I would imagine that the vast majority of community doctors would be surprised to hear that they can actually enhance their revenue stream by conducting clinical research. I do wonder if any of them might ask, well, if the money is supposed to cover the cost of research, but I'm having positive revenue, is it ethical?
And when you think about the ethics behind it, there is a lens of having fair market value kind of as a theme embedded in lots of aspects of the research. So as you're thinking about budgets, contracts, all of that, there's a fairly strict definition of what you can pay for reimbursements for treatments and what you can pay a physician, what you can even pay for a patient to take part in research. So all of that, I think that ethical components, is something that needs to be part of the discussion. And I think there's ethical boards and all that help review and provide feedback to ensure that nothing is out of whack there and that the right considerations are in place and that there's, everything is transparent and visible as well. So, while it's something that I think is, should be part of the consideration set, and I think a lot of physicians should, ask those types of questions, I think there's a good answer to say, yes, it can be done, and it can be done in a way that that shouldn't provide really any concerns in that regard.
It's also part to build on what you've said, Chris. Part of the key is ensuring that the right type of study is matched with a certain type of site. So if there are way too many touch points, way too many visits for practice that is just struggling to meet its day-to-day clinical workflow, then you might overload them and they may not have the right resources, they may not have enough physician time, et cetera. So you have to also ensure, I think, that the appropriate study is part of that consideration and it can help determine whether a site is in the red or in the green with respect to research outcomes.
Great. Thank you so much for that clarification. I did want to ask you about something else. There is this relatively new idea called pragmatic trials, I think designed to evaluate effectiveness of interventions in practical conditions. Could you explain what that is and talk about the notion of pragmatic trials?
Sure. And I think maybe just to counter it, to make sure we understand what we've talked about, or say when people talk about clinical trials, I think the first kind of lens that people think about is more of your traditional randomized controlled trials. And this is really the set of trials where you're trying to minimize all of those confounding factors that could potentially, make understanding that efficacy and safety and all of those things more challenging to understand. And that's where you have, very tightly controlled inclusion and exclusion criteria that govern what things, will allow a patient to be considered to take part. And ultimately, it's getting you to an understanding of how well a treatment may work or how well that intervention works in an optimal setting. So I think the counter of that is really the pragmatic trial view, which is just an alternative approach to thinking about how you conduct research and how you can set up studies and trials where, perhaps you're able to collect data in an observational setting. But I think that the anchor point for these types of programs is that it's more reflective of the real world and routine clinical practice. And I think, that approach, doesn't mean that, you're able to potentially deduce these types of approaches typically don't have the same level of restrictions in the patient populations because they want to understand how people with various comorbidities are affected and really want to make sure that those results are generalizable to that broader public. So I do think that when you think about pragmatic studies compared to, say, compared to placebos that the randomized controlled trials do, pragmatic studies are focused on comparing standard of care. And that's really kind of, again, another anchor point of what's there and how you think about what these patients are using in their normal practice.
Neil, did you want to address how that works with phase four trials?
So in addition, many phase four trials are set up using this type of approach. It's an area where we believe we're going to see a lot of continued growth. And there should be broad reach into the community and the diversity of patient populations that are accessible. And this can be really valuable. There's increased technology capability that will enable us to capture new and broader types of patient data. And that'll make it easier to aggregate these data into larger pools for further analysis and then offer the promise of reducing costs in the future.
So we've talked so far about the myriad of barriers to doing clinical research in community practice. But we're supposed to be talking about innovation and transformation. So let's change gears and hear about what you see as some of the possible solutions. Can you describe your vision or what innovative approaches can help overcome some of these barriers and ideally democratize clinical trials? Let's start with pharma.
At its very highest level, that vision for democratizing trials starts with the ability to create a strong network of community and small practices. Being able to bring together those types of sites, those types of physicians, and the broader patients that are taking part in their clinical care at these centers. I think that's the anchor point that we see and a foundation that I think allows you to change the start of the landscape. And I think the second part of it is ensuring that there's the right set of technologies, processes, and resources. So really that support structure and infrastructure that's in place to allow, what we'll call a next generation of type of network and research that can take place. So it's how you enable them to effectively, efficiently deliver research. Again, back to that theme of with as minimal friction as possible. You want to remove those administrative burdens, but you want to do it in a way that helps them kind of go through the steps that are needed, in terms of what is required from good clinical practice. And how can we find ways to enhance what the real world data at these sites and patients is ultimately able to generate down the line. So if you think about that then from how pharma needs to overcome some of these barriers. I think one of the challenges that needs to be addressed, and I think the solution is you need to show them evidence. And this is, you know, you saw it a little bit in the technology piece that we touched on, and you know, things that have been available are now getting pulled through because they've seen it add value. It's just, I think it's the same concept here where you need proof points, you need to see some pilots where you're able to kind of, you know, have these types of relationships that exist. You need to be able to deliver on time, on study with this broader set of patients and help show them that A, it can be done, but it can be done really in an effective way that doesn't, you know, doesn't add any additional time or risk into their programs. And I think once you're able to kind of, you know, have that demonstration, you'll be able to go beyond where you are today and really think about how this broader set of patients that exists, that these patients can ultimately be beneficial for them too. And I think one way to think about how to help bring this forward as a priority for them centers around their relationship with, you know, what we talked about earlier, the key opinion leaders. And these are physicians, these are thought leaders in specific therapeutic areas. These physicians are often contracted by, you know, the pharmaceutical industry to take part in the early planning stages of a research program. And they help, understand what are those real world challenges that may exist, and really help ensure that the approach and the design of a study is going to be achievable, but that, you know, what they're targeting is actually meaningful as well. And I think if we have the ability to, you know, help these KOLs voice, you know, a priority and a need in this space, you know, we'll be able to help better embed those goals for better, you know, and broader representation at the outset. And that will be able to then get pulled through by having a network that is able to kind of deliver some of that.
Well, we've also seen that recently a few of the large pharmaceutical companies, for example, both Johnson & Johnson and Bristol Myers have made large public financial commitments, each over something like $100 million, to do more in the area of health equity. So we think this is a start of a real trend and a focus and a call to action, and that this is going to be addressing some of the challenges that we've identified.
The clinical trial space has probably never been more front and center in the community than what you see today in the pandemic. And you know, one of the leading players for a vaccine, Moderna, has publicly come out and you know, said that they slowed their trial recruitment, you know, near the end to ensure that the diversity of patients that it felt needed to represent that broader patient population was embedded in the data and the research that they were putting together. So if you step back, you know, their CEO was very explicit in this area to say that, you know, this is something that they're going to continue to prioritize and put attention on in their studies moving forward. But, you know, if, you know, at a time when everybody's pushing and hoping for a vaccine to come forward, and, you know, a leading company is, you know, thinking about this, embedding this in what they're doing, I think it serves notice to the rest of the community to say this is something that is a shift in the landscape and something that, you know, gives us a chance to move to something that is more truly representative. So I think it's an exciting change, and I think that sentiment will get pulled through in other you know, pharma partners as well.
Oh, Chris, when I heard Moderna's CEO speak on the radio, I rejoiced to hear his words. So nice, the right things are coming for clinical care amongst the pharmaceutical community, and maybe even a hint of altruism as well. So can you talk next about the ideas to overcome physician barriers?
I think when you think about, you know, some of those physician barriers, that timing, the administrative and infrastructure challenges, I think you need a mechanism to offload that burden as much as possible. You know, remove it from the practice, remove it from the physicians. So things that can be done where you centralize that technology, the tools, and staff that can support them in different ways. I think that serves as a component of it. And you need this really at all phases of a clinical program, you know, where, you know, at the outset, you're thinking about feasibility, thinking about contracting and startup through that full delivery until the study is fully closed. All of those steps need support. And again, I think providing a foundation and infrastructure and team to help support that is one way to do it.
Yeah, well, one approach is to provide shared staff that can be brought on site to provide additional support when it makes sense. And also advising these sites who might not have very much experience in executing research on their budgets and their contracts and ways to minimize risk, and helping them set up SOP standard processes.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you think about how to bring that together, a network allows the ability to accelerate some of that learning, best practice capturing, sharing. And I think if you're able to do that and have a meaningful connection across some of those practices and sites, you know, you are able to drive more of that impact. So I think that needs to be a core theme again in terms of, you know, how you pull that through and deliver for the physicians and the sites.
So it sounds like those networks actually may not only facilitate doing clinical studies, but also might improve patient care amongst the network of physicians since they're sharing information and experience. So I'm going to turn to the patients. I know Neil and Chris, you both said that the physicians really are necessary to have on board, but that's not everything that has to happen to resolve some of the patient barriers. Can you talk about how you would resolve those patient barriers?
Getting that broader set of physicians and their practices engaged is a great first step. And you know, I think we've said that physician-patient relationship is such a critical aspect to addressing the trust. And I think, you know, the closer that relationship is, the more similar a physician is to the patient in terms of their background, in terms of their race and ethnicity, the more likely that trust can be built, and that, you know, those recommendations, you know, will be followed through. And I think, you know, we have to go beyond, you know, some of those things that are there today. Raise that understanding and awareness with the patients, you know, beyond what they have visibility to, and find ways to connect with the patient population and really build and sustain that trust in a different way.
And in addition, in helping to overcome patient barriers, we need to establish stronger community engagement, and that will require finding the right opportunities and channels to engage. The solutions should empower more community physicians and their diverse patients to take part in research. And it means that the therapies would be adopted faster, and the therapies would be more available to the patients who need these medications if they do participate in research.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of power in community participation, both in medicine and in management of chronic disease. So I'd like to turn now, since we've heard some solutions to barriers, I want to ask you to look into your crystal ball. If you could realize your vision and overcome most of the barriers you identified, who would you imagine would be the customers for your vision?
When you think about this type of ecosystem, there's a number of stakeholders across that landscape, and you know, each one has a part in that solution. But in terms of, you know, some might be paying customers, others might be kind of playing supporting roles to both deliver or enable that solution to be better. But from a paying customer lens, I think it has to be, and it has to start with both that pharmaceutical biotech, then the clinical research companies, the CROs that really help support and deliver a lot of that work. In a lot of ways, they are the decision maker in terms of what research is done, where that research takes place, and really, you know, what level of funding is going to support it. So, you know, there needs to be an ability to reach, you know, a broader set of those stakeholders to bring in and make sure that they see that potential value of having a broader, more diverse, you know, group of physicians and patients involved. And I think with that, you also have the ability to really generate a data set that is more representative, that, you know, hasn't been able to really been pulled together before. And I think that's an exciting aspect as well. By having a path to deliver, you know, research faster, by having an ability to, you know, already have awareness and, you know, the start of adoption in the communities and the patients that need these treatments the most, I think you're actually bringing a value proposition to those pharma and biotech customers that they'll be able to realize.
So physicians are a clear stakeholder as well and an essential enabler of the vision. And they should also benefit from a new solution. And first and foremost, I say the solution that gives them the ability to stay on the leading edge of research and treatment paradigms, and then in addition, offer research as a care option, should be very exciting for most physicians. We've mentioned before the opportunity to diversify and augment their financials. And a revenue stream is really important, an alternate one, particularly as the pandemic landscape continues to pressure these types of small and community practices. And finally, and this is an interesting aspect, is that by providing research as a care option, it can also help the patients out-of-pocket costs because these can be covered by the trial. So this is another option that the physicians can offer to their patients.
So what about the tech companies? You had mentioned that the technological advances were clearly part of what makes this possible. Would the tech companies that are developing these tools also be one of the customers?
So I think what you see in the space today, and probably maybe only fueled by some of the growth in that space, is that it's evolving. And you know, specifically in that virtually digitally enabled areas. And I think they're, you know, again, a fundamental enabler to the vision, to kind of a transformative landscape moving forward. And I think, you know, there's going to be some of those players that want to own relationships at every aspect and kind of, you know, be vertically integrated up and down the landscape. But I think what I believe is probably to be more likely is a lot of these technology companies are really going to be want to partner and are going to need that physical site and physician connectivity to be as effective as they want to be. So I think, you know, we see that option of probably partnering you know, in a strategic way as probably the more likely relationship for these types of technology players.
So I find it so interesting that conducting clinical trials in community-based practices really could be advantageous to patients and physicians and even to pharma. So I really thank you for sharing your vision on how the United States actually might realize this. And now, because our guests come from such interesting and varied backgrounds, I'd like to ask a few more personal questions. Neil, you came out of a background as a biotech executive and have been involved with drug discovery and development. What attracted you to join Health 2047?
Well, first and foremost, Health 2047 is the innovation subsidiary of the American Medical Association. It's an almost 200-year-old institution that's focused on promoting the health and science of medicine and the betterment of public health care. Now, that's a mission I can really get behind and one that motivates me to get out of bed in the morning. Health 2047 also has offered me the chance to participate in an exciting and fast-evolving area and a new one for me, and that's the overlap between healthcare and high tech.
Oh, and Chris, you have had extensive experience in the pharma and CRO sphere with a focus on innovation for sites and patients. How did you hear about and get involved with Health 2047?
Yeah, so maybe just to step back first before I answer that, I think my first career and my first job coming out of UVA was at a technology startup. So I came out in the dot-com world, and you know, I was, you know, had this big picture of entrepreneurship as a channel that I wanted to consider. And that bubble burst pretty quickly, and it pushed me, I think, for a long time to bigger companies, you know, as I got into consulting and some other things. But coming out of business school, it was something I was looking at again. I was looking at private equity. I was looking at venture capital as an area that really interested me. And you know, I think one of the things in a lot of the discussions I had with industry kind of players in that space was, you know, guidance and thinking about the space of how can you bring the right level of industry expertise, operational experience to solve really those big challenges that are out there. And I think I took that to heart and kind of went back into the, you know, some of these larger companies in consulting into pharma and in the CRO space. And it's been a great kind of journey to kind of, you know, see pharma, see a lot of this healthcare landscape from a lot of different lenses. But I think, you know, I've always had this interest around entrepreneurship. I think I've stayed connected, you know, through some of my Duke relationships, some of the broader community here in the Raleigh-Durham area. You know, has a pretty vibrant, startup and entrepreneurship scene. And I think it was through some of those relationships and connectivity of where those people were with Health 2047 that really helped kind of make a connection. And they saw the background that I had and thought that there could be, you know, some opportunities to, you know, align the two. And I think, again, when you look at that shared mission that Health 2047 has, of really putting that focus on transforming healthcare. Again, I think that resonated with me as you know, a group that I was, you know, interested in working with.
Yeah, I have to say, most of the people connected with Health 2047 are really mission-driven people, and it's just a pleasure to work with all of them. I do find it interesting what attracts people to healthcare to begin with. What have each of you found most interesting or most challenging about the healthcare sector?
Yeah, so I think going back to the start of my career, I was in consulting for media and entertainment companies, and it was fast-paced. It was very, you know, leading-edge, consumer-focused, and it was really interesting. But you know, I think it left something to be desired, and I don't think it was until after my first experience in healthcare coming out of grad school that I realized that mission, focus, and alignment, and specifically in healthcare. If everything you can do can tie back to how can you help patients, and really having that as the center and focus, I think it just created for me a little bit different mentality and really a clear drive to want to do more. And I think that passion and interest, you know, hasn't wavered from a, you know, from an industry, you know, sector since that point.
On my end, I've had the privilege of experiencing healthcare from multiple different perspectives. So first, starting out as a basic researcher at the National Institutes of Health, then moving on to large pharma, then into the more entrepreneurial arena of biotech, and finally, Health 2047 itself. And similar to what Chris has vocalized, one constant that has stood out for me is that regardless of the lens, people operating in healthcare really do care about doing the right things the right way to ensure the best outcomes for patients.
Oh, that's great. You are both filling my heart, and I am so delighted to work with you at Health 2047. Lastly, perhaps the most revealing question I ask people, Neil and Chris, what do you do for fun? What activities do you enjoy?
I probably need to preface this that I have three wonderful children, ages 12, 9, and 6. So for everyone out there thinking about entrepreneurship and innovation that has kids around those ages, I'm sure it's no surprise that a lot of my activities today are centered around, you know, doing things with them, with my wife. And, you know, I think it spans, you know, everything from helping to coach the sports and activities that they participate in, you know, doing a lot of outdoor adventures. You know, we love traveling and kind of, you know, trying new things. So I think, you know, just had a lot of fun spending time with them, and, you know, we can get into a good bit of trouble as a group and really, you know, spend the time together.
Well, my kids are a little older than yours, Chris, and hopefully not getting into quite as much trouble. But since I live in the beautiful Pacific Northwest, my husband and I really enjoy outdoor activities, especially things like hiking and canoeing.
Well, Neil and Chris, thank you so very much for joining me today. It was a pleasure speaking with you. I was delighted to have this conversation, and I enjoyed learning about innovations in clinical trials. Many special thanks for sharing your vision and plans for transforming and democratizing clinical trials. Thank you, Neil and Chris.
Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure to share some of that story, some of the vision, and kind of where we see that evolution of the space heading. And you know, I think there's a lot of transformation out there that is continuing to happen. And I think there's more we can bring forward together. So excited to be part of it.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of So You Want to Transform Healthcare. Next month, we have a real treat for you. January marks Health 2047's 5th anniversary, and in celebration of that major milestone, I invited two very special guests to share the Health 2047 story, how the organization developed over the past 5 years, and where its leaders aspire to take it. Joining me will be Dr. James Madera, the Chief Executive Officer of the American Medical Association, and Larry Cohen, CEO of Health 2047. I hope you can tune in to hear these visionary leaders talk about healthcare transformation in action. Until then, be well, stay safe, wash your hands, and please wear a mask.